This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, with episode number 749. Thank you so much for joining me on this very last day before, and yes, next time I speak with you here on the show, we will know who the new president of the United States of America is. Wow. What an election it has been. Probably, you know, is this the most entertaining election in U.S. history? I think there's a high likelihood of that. I don't know how it was in the old days, but certainly in modern history, this has got to be the most amazing, and I'm going to say entertaining, election of U.S. history, certainly in my lifetime. So we shall see what happens. We shall see what happens as the continuing revelations come out about the Clinton crime syndicate. Doesn't it just disgust you the way Wall Street people, the way banksters, politicians are just... Basically, what we have, you know, when you look at those ratings of corruption of different countries around the world and how corrupt they are, Ecuador is always up in the top of the list, you know, as a very corrupt country, they say. Russia would be, you know, certainly on the list. Many of these banana republic type countries, you know, are on the list, right? But in the U.S., our corruption is different. Our corruption is what I call legalized corruption. It's basically how many lawyers, accounting firms, PR firms, spin doctors, how many of those people can you afford to hire? Or can you become too big to fail, either as a person or an institution, so that you can commit crimes? And basically, the Clinton crime syndicate is an example of this. And listen, I'm not giving Donald Trump a pass because he's got his own sets of baggage for sure. You know, this Trump University thing. But, you know, Trump is just your typical greedy businessman, right? And he hasn't had, you know, partnership and shareholder scandals the way the Wall Street people do. I mean, the Wall Street people, dramatically worse than Donald Trump. You know, no matter what side of the political aisle you're on, I mean, you just have to admit, Hillary is a criminal. I mean, this Clinton crime syndicate has gone on for decades. It is mind-boggling to me. It is truly mind-boggling. And we shall see, you know, this is a very, very close race. Certainly there's lots of evidence that it is rigged, as they say. And remember, I want to do this documentary still called Rigged Movie. And the tagline is, heads they win, tails we lose. Yes, it is a bit of a pessimistic headline. And if there are any people out there who could help me get this documentary project that, you know, admittedly, I have not spent much time on this or tried very hard because I got so many other things going on out there. I would like to do a documentary on the rigged financial system, how it is rigged against the little guy, the rigged legal system, how it is rigged against the little guy, rigged elections, you know, as a documentary series The pharmaceutical industry is rigged. The overall healthcare industry is rigged. The voting booth is rigged. There are so many rigged things in our society that is just, it is just appalling. It really is. And you know, I could see how this kind of stuff could happen in the old days when people weren't connected and communication wasn't phenomenal like it is today. It's an amazing time to be alive. I always say that, and it is certainly true. But today, when the world is so interconnected and the secrets are out, the jig is up. The monetary system is rigged. I didn't even mention that one a moment ago, as we often talk about the Federal Reserve and fiat money and the way that whole thing is rigged. The episode, just the last episode, number 748, Jim Cramer, you know, a well-respected guy in the world of the stock market. Again, his own statements talking about how it is rigged. The words from his own mouth, how he basically brags about fooling the SEC and manipulating the market. It's just mind-boggling, isn't it, folks? It is absolutely, positively mind-boggling. Now, I have talked many times before about how the next 10 years of demographics and psychographics, in other words, people's state of mind, not just demographics, and also economics, how they bode so well for us as real estate investors, how there is this tsunami, this tidal wave, this absolute avalanche of great news for us as real estate investors coming at the rental market over the next decade, maybe longer, really, really, maybe this is a 15 to 20 year, maybe this is a decade and a half, two decades of phenomenal opportunity for us as real estate investors. I don't know. It remains to be seen. But certainly the near future, the next 3 to 5 years, and I would even venture to say the next 5 to 7, the next decade, it looks pretty darn sure that we are in a phenomenal, phenomenal position as real estate investors, investing in the most historically proven asset class in the entire world, income-producing real estate. Well, here is a recent survey, and I believe I shared a little bit of this with you on a prior episode, but I'm going to go into a little more detail this time because we've got one of our clients coming on the show today, and that is Mr. Gary Pinkerton. Yes, Gary Pinkerton, the now retired Navy submarine captain. Yes, this guy can actually run a nuclear reactor. Pretty cool, huh? He's going to be back on the show today, talking a little bit about some different issues in the economy, some different data that I think you'll find interesting, and a bit of his client case study as a real estate investor. So I think you'll like that. But before we get to that, this is about the American savings rate. And again, this is one more piece of evidence just proving how phenomenal the opportunity is for us, for real estate investors, for income property investors. And it is overall sad news. But you know me, I am a realist. I am realistic about this stuff. I do think it's an amazing time to be alive. There are so many incredible things going on. And at the same time, there is this divide. There is the digital divide. There is the economic divide. There is the concentration of wealth divide. There are a lot of problems, obviously, at the same time. And this is one of them. But as the Chinese say, crisis is an opportunity riding the dangerous wind. Every problem is an opportunity. In the Chinese language, the symbol for crisis is identical to the symbol for opportunity. So literally translated, crisis is an opportunity riding the dangerous wind is the way that works, right? And so this is a crisis, but it is an opportunity for us as real estate investors. It is an opportunity to serve a huge segment of the population. And when you hear a couple of these stats momentarily, you're going to see that this segment is ginormous. Ginormous. Yes, I know that's not a word, listeners. I know it's not a word. It's one of those made-up words. But it's ginormous. That would be gigantic and enormous put together. There you go. I don't think you needed me to explain that, did you? But anyway, I'm kind of a literal person. Okay, so 62% of Americans have under $1,000 in savings. And this is a survey. Who did this survey here? God dang it. Well, it's on Go Banking Rates, gobankingrates.com, which I guess is a website like bankrate.com, it looks like. And they've got some cool charts here, colorful graphs that illustrate all this stuff. But let me just share with you the first one before we get to our client, Gary Pinkerton, and our guest today and talk to him. Okay, so 21% do not have a savings account. 21% of the population. Mind-boggling. Okay. 28% have $0. I guess they have an account, but they have no money, or maybe no money to speak of in the account. Maybe if they have a nominal amount of money in that account just to keep it open, it's counted that way as $0. 14% have, hey, this is considered great. Now, I'm sure people listening will think this is, you know, no big deal, right? But 14% of the population, over $10,000, $10,000 or more in savings. Okay, let's go to the bottom rung again. That's the top rung, over 10,000, 10,000 or more. Just the minimum balance requirement, 9% of the population. Less than $1,000 in the bank in savings, 13% of the population. $1,000 to $4,999, 10% of the population. $5,000 to $9,999, 5% of the population. 14% of the population with 10,000 or more. Can you believe that? That means that 62% of the American population, now I assume, of course, this is the adult population we're talking about, you know, a little baby wouldn't be counted in this, right? But 62% of the population have less than $1,000 in savings. Do you think they're going to be able to move into the homeownership pool anytime soon? Do you think they're going to be home buyers? Not likely, folks. This is a huge market. It is a market of opportunity. It is a market that needs to be served. Hopefully, our country will get its act together and we will start moving away from these idiotic left-wing policies that I would argue, because we've had 5 decades of left-leaning policies in this country. Okay, forget about who the president is, right? Just look at the Congress. The Congress has largely been controlled by the left for the better part of 5 decades. And in many ways, you can argue that this problem relates to our left-leaning social policies because it causes an anemic economy through government spending, through inflation, admittedly low in recent years, but overall, over the last 5 decades, very high, especially since 1971. You know what happened in that year, of course, went off the gold standard. So this is just mind-boggling. It really is. Showing once more, once again, that there is a massive opportunity and a massive market that needs to be served for us and by us as real estate investors. Okay, without further ado, let's get to our guest today. Let's talk to Gary. We're going to talk about some charts and some data and a little bit of case study. Make sure you visit jasonhartman.com. Make sure you check out our new website, by the way, if you haven't done so yet. It's newly revised website. If you looked at it too early, there were a lot of things that we fixed on it. So go take another look. Maybe you looked at it too soon, but take a look at it. A lot of great resources there. Some great products in the store, and also at HartmanEducation.com. And we are planning a phenomenal Venture Alliance weekend in very easy to get to Phoenix. One of the, voted actually the, not one of, but the friendliest airport in the United States, which I would agree with. I love the Phoenix airport. It's real, real easy, really short lines, really fast to get in, get out. It's a great airport. Love it there. So join us in Phoenix for the Venture Alliance weekend. That's the first weekend of December. Visit VentureAllianceMastermind.com or JasonHartman.com. Click on events and make sure you join us for that. You can come as a one-time guest or you can join. We've got a couple of great new members and we got some fantastic speakers that we're lining up for this event. One of them, an excellent guest who's been on our show before. I'm not going to tell you who he was, but he was phenomenal, really amazing insights on the economy and the markets. He will be speaking at our Venture Alliance event in Phoenix, first weekend of December, and we're going to have some other fantastic guest speakers and some fantastic, fun, first-class events. So be sure to join us, Venture Alliance weekend, first weekend of December. Let's go to Gary. Hey, it's my pleasure to welcome one of our clients back to the show. He is also a Venture Alliance member, and that is Mr. Gary Pinkerton, who sent me a fascinating article on Vox.com last week, and it's entitled 27 Charts That Will Change How You Think About the American Economy by Timothy Lee. And this is just a fascinating group of charts. Gary has picked out some of his favorites he wanted to chat about and maybe ask me some questions about. See if he can stump me on any of these. I always have an opinion, even if it's wrong. That's my disclaimer. And Gary, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm doing great, and I'm really looking forward to talking again. I always love being, I think this is my third one, maybe second one. I think I did an intro with you. If I count that, it's the third one, but really enjoyed each time and certainly love talking about these topics.
Yeah. It's great to have you back on the show. And Gary, give our listeners a sense of geography. You're an East Coast guy. Where are you located exactly?
So I'm in New Jersey, Belmar, New Jersey, which if you're ever heading up the New Jersey Turnpike, you'll see the turn for Six Flags and 195, and it says Shore Points. And so we're basically halfway between New York City and Atlantic City there on the coast of New Jersey. Just a beautiful place, and it was the epicenter for Hurricane Sandy a few years ago.
Yeah, massive rebuilding project there for sure. But you've been a Venture Alliance Mastermind member from the beginning, and I thank you for being involved in Venture Alliance. It's been great to have you there, and you always contribute such great stuff, and you've got such a good financial mind and, you know, very analytical. You are a recently retired Navy submarine captain, so you know how to run a nuclear reactor in your spare time, right?
I do. I've done a few of those. Yeah, it's not easy work, but it's certainly challenging, and you know, very satisfying. You know, just a ton of great memories. I just finished actually my 25th reunion at the Naval Academy. Saw a bunch of submarine buddies, as well as, you know, just pilots and surface warship guys and Marines, and some great Americans that I'd kind of lost touch with. So great times. But yep, did do some times in nuclear reactors.
Wow, that's amazing. And you know, the sad thing about that whole deal with your naval career for me is that whenever I want to ask you questions about these nuclear submarines, you can't tell me anything because it's all secret. It's all classified. You know, you won't tell me how deep you go, how fast you go. It's just nothing, right?
Well, the good news is that the longer I'm out, the less relevant I become. And, you know, I'm getting older like all of us, right? So eventually they'll think I'm senile and I'll be able to tell you the answers.
There you go. Yeah, that's how you'll blow your security clearance. Okay. Got it. Well, hey, Gary, what got you interested in real estate, and how long ago did you discover my podcast and become a client?
So it was 2011, just about mid-2011. I was leaving command. I'd just taken over a position, a great job at the Naval Academy, a two-year position there, and I had a lot more free time than I did on my submarine, as you can imagine, and I was searching for a way to shift active income into passive. You know, I'd read Robert Kiyosaki's books over the years. They just spoke to me. Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and most of the others, his prophecy, it all just made a lot of sense to me. So I was looking for, following his model of shifting into passive cash flow income. And, I'm a mechanical engineer, and the thing that made most sense to me, not buying the coin laundry machine, although I think that facility may be a great idea too. But for me, it was about real estate and buildings. And so I was looking into that. You happen to have a great podcast, and I started listening in the teens, I think it was, and I've certainly listened to all of them. And I just have kind of become a junkie of that and of Real Estate Guys Radio. I listen to them quite a bit as well. And I got my first property in the end of 2011 in St. Louis. I bought a few more there. I'm up to eight, and my wife Susan is today. In fact, we'll get her first three, and she'll be at six by the end of this month. And hopefully, if all goes well, we'll have Susan topped out, and then we'll go back and start focusing on Gary again.
And what you're referring to is the 10 loans for each spouse, the 10 Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac loans for each spouse. I got a question for you about living on a submarine and working on a submarine. Maybe you can actually answer this one, and I have a feeling I already know the answer. Are you able to download my podcast when you're underwater?
So, no, not very far underwater. We consider Periscope depth underwater, and we can actually do that nowadays in certain circumstances. So it's when you're basically on training missions, you're not someplace where you need to be really covert. So we do have satellite capabilities, and we can get internet. We can, chat back and forth with family members now. It's totally different than it was 20 years ago when I started this process.
Yeah, that's great to let all the people, in the military be more in touch with their families and so forth. That's got to really be a morale booster, I'm sure. So that's fantastic. Well, hey, these 27 charts are fascinating. This is just a really interesting article. You wanted to talk about some of them with our listeners. You're an economics wonk, and you're really into this stuff, as am I. Which ones would you like to go over? Maybe let's pick a few of them and talk about them.
So I think we should talk, just about the first few, and then we'll jump forward a little bit. But the first one, number one is kind of an eye catcher, probably on purpose. But he says, and he starts things off here by saying that, yes, America still makes things. And he's talking about the manufacturing sector, real output. He shows, a trend from 1987 to the present. And as you would expect, it went down pretty substantially in 2008 and 2009. But it's back up, and it's at the highest level of production since they started recording since the beginning of this chart in 1987. And I think that does surprise people, but I believe also that I'd be interested in your thoughts. But I think the perspective is that, no one works in industry anymore. And that's somewhat true because, he talks about it
because
in here.
Because it's automated.
right. The efficiency of the companies. But, the bottom line is that America is still producing quite a few goods.
Right. So if you look at the manufacturing job sector, it is suffering dramatically. But if you look at manufacturing output, it's still very strong. So this is the paradox of automation and robotics and technology in general. And what it may be leading to is the fact that, even some of my most, and I shouldn't say as the fact that, but maybe it is a reality, a harsh reality, that some of even my most libertarian friends are beginning to face is that maybe we are going to have a large segment of the population that is just permanently unemployed or massively underemployed, and maybe the government will have to provide a living wage of some sort to these people to keep the world stable. But that isn't as bad as it might sound, because all of this technology makes goods so much less expensive that, maybe you can do that for a lot less money. And then it goes to the question of, you know, my investing philosophy that is, you know, I say inflation is the home run. That's the best of all scenarios, but a lot of this is anti-inflationary. The monetary and fiscal policy, very inflationary. Technology is its opponent. It is not inflationary. So we shall see which way it will go. But there's a couple charts that actually relate to that as well, right, Gary?
That's right, yeah. So one of them is, you know, even just going to chart two, still talking about manufacturing. You know, it shows that the jobs in the service sector have been steadily climbing while the jobs in manufacturing are flat or going down a little bit, even while, you know, U.S. population is growing. And my question was, is that really bad? You know, kind of back to your comment, I'm not sure it's bad. You know, manufacturing jobs are not, you know, a dream, in my opinion. I've done a few of them, and they're hard work, and people don't live really long lives. And in general, they don't enjoy, you know, the back-breaking work that comes along with that. So, you know, the people will often reminisce about the good old days. I'm not sure they were good old days in the factories, you know?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And many experiments and issues and labor unions and child labor and the Hawthorne experiment and working conditions and so forth speak to a lot of that point that you raise about manufacturing jobs. The other thing it says, if you look at the other side of this issue and you look at it not from the producer and the job and employment side, but you look at it from the consumer side, generally speaking, manufacturing jobs to me represent needs, but largely, not completely, but largely. They represent things people consider necessities or needs, you know, having a car, having clothing, having a house, having all the goods that we buy, right? But services really represent wants, and they represent a higher level of lifestyle. So when it comes to massages and going out to eat at restaurants, you know, concierge type jobs and all of these service oriented jobs, even the Lyft and the Uber driver, these are sort of higher level things. They're things that really indicate a degree of progress in that life is getting better and people are more prosperous. I mean, I was talking to my mom somewhat recently about the obesity epidemic, and she says, you know, Jason, maybe it's just the fact that just people go out to eat so much more often. I mean, when she was a kid, nobody ever went out to eat. You know, you just didn't do that. It was way too expensive. And when I was a kid, certainly the restaurant world was not nearly as big as it is today. And so that represents a huge growth in the service sector, right? I mean, would you agree with that? Do you know, like service jobs are a sign of prosperity, I think.
I agree. And it's prosperity and a lot of those being type elective type services that you go for, like you mentioned, you know, being able to ride around in an Uber. But they're also, I think, an indication of longevity, because I think there's a lot of service industry coming from, you know, all of the retired baby boomers and for those older than the baby boomers that need those kinds or desire those kinds of services and have the ability to pay for them. You know, I mean, the cruise ship industry right now is booming. Some of it, I think, is because of lower fuel costs. But I think a lot of it is the fact that the people who want to go and travel now are still healthy enough to do it, have, you know, service providers to help them through that, and thankfully have the financial ability to do it. And, you know, cruise ships are a service industry. So, you know, I think as you look around, it's an indication, like you said, of a wealthier, healthier, happier society. I don't think this is a bad thing.
Yeah. It's an amazing time to be alive. Yeah, good
it
stuff.
It is.
Okay. So anything else you take from chart number two? Manufacturing employment is dwindling while more and more people provide services.
No, I don't think so. But, you know, there's a couple more that relate to that. And those are number 12, labor force participation rate. And then I'll kind of lump them together. And then like 15, you know, teen summer employment. And then both are, you know, are dropping off. I think the labor force participation rate, that's somewhat to do with, you know, the crash that we had in 2008 and 2009 and the one in 2000. Both of them caused a significant drop. And clearly we haven't come back from that. But again, I think it's about increased efficiency as well right now, you know, in the industrial world. And I think people are struggling a little bit. We have this impression that service jobs are lower income jobs and they're jobs that, you know, are beyond, you know, I'm beyond having to do that kind of a job. And I think that's unfortunate. I think service jobs provide a great benefit, like we just talked about. And I think if we could change the mentality on that and perhaps change the pay structure for that.
Well, I think one of the interesting things about that is, you know, when you talk about service jobs, most people think of, oh, working in a restaurant or a coffee shop or something like that. They don't pay very well, those jobs, certainly. But, you know, it's not that we have to just talk about this as though it's two things. It's either a service job or a manufacturing job. What about a corporate job? What about a middle management type of job? You know, the information worker, the people working in the offices, right? They don't fall into either category. And those tend to be higher paying jobs, and they tend to be more pleasant jobs than manufacturing or service, I would say. You know, they're using the brain more than the brawn in either case.
Yeah, I agree. And but, you know, regardless, chart 12, people have been dropping out of the labor force since about 2000, is a bit of a disturbing chart. You know, because if you follow that arrow further, I wrote Greece at the end of, you know, of that arrow where, you know, for whatever reason, the labor force, whether it be entitlement, whether it be disenfranchisement, whether it be taxes are so high they don't bother, you know, that is the direction. I think America is moving on this chart in the direction of Europe, where for whatever reason, people don't go to work, and that's not a good thing.
That's very unfortunate. And folks, the labor force participation rate is far more accurate than the unemployment rate. Because as we've talked about many, many times, and I'd say the guest that spoke to this the most was John Williams, the founder of ShadowStats.com, a website I would highly encourage all of you to visit, ShadowStats.com, which is, you know, sort of made its name on the, you know, the reality behind the numbers that the government is publishing. The labor force participation rate really shows you who's working and who's not, right? Whereas the unemployment rate, because people fall off the unemployment rolls, that is a very misleading number. So let's just share some actual numbers here. Okay. Let's take 1997-ish to 2000, it looks like, we had a labor force participation rate of 67, and now it's down to less than 63. And the last time it was this low was, you know, in the era where the misery index was created in the 70s, in the mid-70s. Things were very, very tough back then, obviously. Yeah, it's just interesting to look at this, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It certainly is. And hopefully we turn that trend. But the other thing to kind of keep in mind, and I learned this in my master's program, my engineering master's program, is you have to take charts with a grain of salt, meaning that you kind of need to know what's behind them, like, you know, what the data set was, what the entering constraints were. But the other part is that, you know, the scale on these things, you have to look at it and kind of evaluate it. I mean, this looks like a very dramatic scale, but I mean, a very dramatic curve. But if you look at it, it's going from 59 to 67%, which is substantial with a country this large. But it's not like it. I mean, you first look at it and you think, oh, my gosh, we were at 10, we went to 100, and we're back down to 50 or so. You know, it's not.
That's one of the old how to lie with statistics things. You show someone a chart, and depending on the scale in which they did the chart, they can make it look much more dramatic than it really is. So that's a very good point.
Hey, two that are on real estate, Jason, I thought we ought to touch. Charts 18 and 19, right back to back. And 18 is the current recovery is an urban recovery, and it shows, it breaks up the chart into four different groups, communities of less than 100,000, between 100 and 500,000, between 500 and a million, and then over 1 million. And what it shows, early 90s, the most of the growth was in the very low population areas.
Mm, yeah.
And then, you know, in 2000, 2006, it was pretty flat and low across the board. But then now the trend from 2010 to 14, following the mortgage crisis, all of the growth has been, you know, in the larger cities.
Yeah, that's interesting, you know, and this is a really complicated one to look at, because one of the other issues that you have is some of these actual cities have grown, like growth begets growth, right? And so if you look at where I spent most of my adult life in Orange County, California, I remember when I first started selling real estate in Irvine, California, the population of that city was like 70,000, okay? And those are misleading too, because these cities are contiguous, you know, they're right next to each other, and you go from Irvine to Newport Beach, or Irvine to Santa Ana, or Irvine to Tustin, or Mission Viejo, or whatever, it's like you're in the same place, you know, so some metro areas are isolated where there's a distance between them, there's a buffer of nothingness, if you will, and then there's another metro area, right? But when they're all clumped together, it really makes it hard to do statistics. But I would say, you know, and I haven't kept up with it, but I'm guessing that the size of the Irvine population now is about 220,000 or something like that. So, and I could be wrong about that, by the way, maybe under 200,000. I'm not sure. It's interesting to look at this. Yeah. So this would lead one to believe that the growth is in the cities, right? In the bigger, well, this is county size, right? Yeah, yeah. And you know, if you look at it on county, like LA and Orange County are right next to each other. You know, you don't notice when you go from one to the other. They're completely adjacent. So it's hard to tell, but go ahead with what you're saying.
Well, what I was going to say is that, you know, this really speaks to the logic behind what you do in your company, in that you pick areas that are surrounding major cities where, you know, it's rural enough or outside the city enough that the numbers still work. But you're close enough to the city to grasp this, you know, population and job growth. You know, people can still commute from where we're buying properties around Atlanta, or, you know, where I bought properties in St. Louis, or, you know, the other major cities that we're concentrating on. They can still go into where that large growth is occurring for jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So they've still got the job opportunity without being in the expensive market. And Gary, you know, I think this is like the ultimate formula. I don't know how expensive it is where you live, but I know your property taxes are some of the highest in the country. That I do know in New Jersey. You know, when you can live in a place that offers a good economy, a good entrepreneurial environment, good entertainment options, good weather, and you can do that inexpensively. You know, I mean, look at the difference between like, and we're not doing anything in this market lately because it just got too expensive, but relative to the comparison I'm going to make, it's incredibly cheap. And so I would compare Denver and Austin, right? Two cities that we've done a fair amount of business in, both a little too expensive now to be recommending to our investors, but compare them to a place like, say, San Francisco, right? These are both called creative class cities, as is San Francisco, and they're dramatically better values. And I just think that the uber high-priced cities are, I don't think they have as good a future, relatively speaking, to the low-priced cities that have a lot of the same offerings, you know? And people are very mobile nowadays, as we've illustrated before. But, you know, any thoughts on that?
No, and you know, over a million in a county is not a lot, right? So this is not just New York City. I think there's great counties here that demonstrate, again, that I just believe I think you're right. I think there's a lot less opportunity in the uber rich large cities. But I think this chart speaks to, you know, the strategy that we've been using for many years with your company. I think it's great.
Right. Yeah. And, yeah. Let's talk about inflation adjusted housing prices.
Yeah. I love this one. 19. Yeah. So what I did, Jason, is I went back and looked at this. And now here's a case of a chart that includes tremendously more information, right? So this one goes back to 1890. Most of them have been 1980s or 1990s, maybe even 2000. Very small sample size. This one is, you know, since they started recording this information 130 years ago. And I took inflation and adjusted it by 1% higher than they show here. And essentially this thing flattens out and the guy's argument goes away. His argument is that since, you know, World War II, housing prices have consistently climbed, and he even calls into question whether the 2008-2009 bubble was significant or not. I mean, you can even look on his chart, and it was huge. So that's a kind of a weird argument to make, but even just, you know, his point is that you can see kind of an upward trend, but for that many years, you know, we're looking at 70 years, if you just add 1% to the reported inflation, it flattens this thing out completely.
I tell you, I have a lot of disagreement with Robert Shiller. And this is, of course, the Yale economist, and the Case-Shiller Index is named after him. And he's written several books. He talks about irrational exuberance. He took Alan Greenspan's famous quote and talks about that. And he doesn't really give the whole picture on a lot of things. And I think that can be kind of misleading. Some of his data is great, of course. But the thing that is so misleading about charts like this is that it assumes that the house is the same house. See, the house in 1890, I'm just going to venture to guess, I'm going to make a wild guess here, is not as nice as the house in 2010, right?
It might have been if they included the outhouse as part of the house.
There you go, yeah. Right, exactly. So it's not as nice a house for sure. I mean, the houses today are much more energy efficient. Well, they even have energy. You know, my grandmother in upstate New York, rest her soul, but when she was alive and I used to go visit there, I mean, all the wiring, all the electrical wiring was on the outside of the walls. You know, so you would see wires running around the inside of the house to an outlet. And because the house was built before electricity was wired into homes. And so the homes are obviously much better, but here's the kicker. And if you look at, like, one stat I hear a lot is that, you know, Americans are just living much more prosperous lives nowadays. And they'll say the average house built after World War II in the baby boom was about 900 square feet. And the average house today is like 2,200 square feet. Okay, but you didn't talk about the density of that house. You didn't talk about the fact that that house post-World War II was a third of an acre or a quarter acre lot in, you know, famous suburban places like, I'll take Lakewood, California as an example, which is a Long Beach area, Long Beach, California, where I went to high school. You know, you compare that to today, and yes, you might have more square footage on the interior of your home, but you're living in a townhome or a high-density cluster home with zero lot lines. So there's more to everything than meets the eye, isn't there?
Absolutely. There absolutely is. Yeah, but I thought that was a fascinating one. And you certainly cannot discount the bubble that shows even on this inflation-adjusted chart. But I believe that consistent climb that it shows from the 1970s on, ironically, if you add 1%, like I said, to the inflation adjustment, it'll flatten it out. And what I meant by ironically is that that's where we started messing with the consumer price index, right? That's where we started taking out volatile things. Shadow stats will tell you that it's a couple of percent higher than that. And when you add that in, you know, it's flat. It's just following home price inflation is long term, with the exception of, you know, the 2008 bubble there. It's just following inflation in America.
Yep, fascinating stuff. You know, a long time ago, and I wish I could find that episode, I did an episode on this where I played part of an interview that was on, I believe, on Bloomberg News, Tom Keene on the economy. He's an interesting reporter. I really like his stuff. And I actually played part of it on there where they interviewed the Fed chair who was it? It was right before
Greenspan.
Gosh, it was before Greenspan, and it was before, you know, the guy that broke the back of inflation, who I always talk about. Why can't I think of his name right now? Volcker, Paul Volcker. Thank you. Little senior moment there. It was before Paul Volcker. There was a Fed chair in there for just a couple of years, and he was talking about how they started manipulating the numbers and how they started using weighting, substitution, hedonics, all of the ways in which they understate inflation. And that was fascinating. I got to find that one and play it as a Flashback Friday episode, because it's really interesting to hear it right there from the inside as to what went on. But Yeah, good stuff. It's an old one. It's up there somewhere, but finding it is another challenge. Okay, so did you want to talk about chart number 20 at all, Gary?
20. I was
housing prices have grown a lot faster than construction costs.
Right. So one of the things I was going to do is say that this is a tribute to, I'm not sure, Jason, you haven't really talked about yet things changing in your life, but it came to mind to me the Turtles, and you'd mentioned this before in the past that you know, some have actual masses around them, like geography, mountains and things that cause prices to rise, water around New York City. Some we just manufacture them. Like one that came to mind for me was Las Vegas, where they have famous, you know, they have endangered turtles that we've decided will prevent you from, you know, expanding. And so home prices go up in places like that as well.
Yeah, right. So in other words, you're talking about constraints on building, right? That cause housing prices to go up a lot faster than real construction costs.
Exactly. So that's one huge part about this, I believe.
Yeah. And this is something, by the way, just to tell the listeners, what this chart shows is it shows from 1980 to 2012. And you see during the bubble period, you know, 2004 to 2006-ish, or while the run-up started happening in 2000. But you see that house prices, real house prices, adjusted for fake inflation statistics, so everything's got to, you know, you got to adjust it twice, right? But they went up dramatically faster than construction costs, right? And that's what this chart shows, which is quite interesting. But that it doesn't tell the whole story, and I think that's Gary's point. You know, correct me if I'm wrong, Gary, but in places where you have constraints on construction, that's what causes places like the Socialist Republic of California to have these incredibly high prices. And my opinion that I've stated many times before when I talk about the self-driving car and the how geography is less meaningful than it's ever been in human history, it's still meaningful. It's just less meaningful. I think this kind of thing will be under attack. It'll still be there. It'll still be a factor, of course. Everybody would rather have a home on the water in Newport Beach or La Jolla or wherever than inland of it, right? I think that'll pretty much be unanimous. But will the delta be as large as it is today if transportation becomes a lot cheaper and a lot easier? Self-driving, ride sharing, et cetera. And also technology like virtual reality, even that's another component. I believe that delta will compress.
No, I think you're right. But this is a nice chart when you're talking about the concept of land value and cost of construction. It shows that the blue line, the real housing price, is essentially the changes in land value, right? I mean, you know, the people that will pay a premium for a specific location over what it costs to build on that location.
Right. But here's the amazing thing about this chart, though. That point is well taken until you get to the peak in, according to this chart, it would be about 2006 or 2007. I think it was really before that. But there's always a lag in these stats anyway. And then you see the dramatic fall of real housing prices, but you see real construction costs increase during that same period. The red line versus the blue line. And I almost wish the listeners could see this. This is really telling. So you see that land prices, when there's a bubble, just get this massive run up, and they're artificial. It's just built on a tulip bulb mania. You know, it's built on a mob mentality, a scarcity mentality that doesn't have any real intrinsic value. And this is why the Hartman Risk Evaluator, I think, is a very valuable lesson here that took me 19 years to discover, is that you should be investing in low land value markets because you don't have that type of volatility. Isn't that fascinating how you see the blue line drop sharply and the red line continues to go up?
Right. It absolutely is. It kind of drives it home. It's such a visual chart. You know, it's something remember, I think, when you start looking at different areas to invest.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. Any others you want to share before we wrap it up, Gary?
Yeah, so 24. 24 is one that shows the way Americans retire is changing. And this one is not really probably news to most people, but it shows the difference between the percentage of Americans that are covered by defined contribution plans or, you know, 401ks, IRAs, self-funded, if you will, and then those that are covered by defined benefit, which is just a pension system. And this chart is really one of those things that I'm kind of dedicating my, you know, the next part of my next chapter of my life towards, and with Patrick Donahoe at Paradigm Life, is trying to get people in a position where they don't fall victim to this, because this is a tragic, you know, occurrence, and you can see that it's been happening since we started, you know, since we made that shift in the late 70s, early 1980s, and it's just getting worse and worse. And there's a comment at the bottom. He says that, this shifts a lot more risk and responsibility onto the employees. So back, you know, with a pension system, which is really just an annuity, the company would outsource to someone like an insurance company the commitment to pay income to their previous employees in retirement, you know, for the rest of their life. And so that individual had quite a bit of security there. But it became expensive to the companies, and they found an opportunity. They found that Congress would allow, or that the governments would allow them to shift this over to the employee. And I would argue that it doesn't shift more risk. I think it shifts all the risk to the individual because, you know, recent studies, in 2015, there were a couple of really big studies that showed that, and he talks about it in here as well, that, you know, actually goes over to the next chart, the median family has just $5,000 saved for retirement. And those...
Wow, that is so scary. Yeah. I mean, that is just mind-boggling. When I hear those studies about how the average person in America has this, and I don't know the amount, but this tiny little amount of money in their bank account, it is just shocking. But you know what it means? It means they're going to be renters for a long, long time.
So, you know, I find that to be, pretty rough, pretty harsh statement about how many people are going to be completely beholden on the U.S. Social Security system. You know, less than 10% of the people right now that are over the age of 55 have more than 130,000 saved. And 130,000 with today's interest rates, if you're planning to use, you know, a spend down of your retirement money, is just a couple hundred dollars, you know, a month. So it's not a good plan, and it's something that's going to result in people, as we said, being really beholden on Social Security and also working probably longer than they originally planned.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I mean, as terrible as that sounds, and I agree with everything you've said, I don't know that working longer is a terrible thing either, though. You know, I mean, the concept of a 65-year-old retiring, that really needs to be redone. Now, granted, you know, that's a sign of how things aren't going as well as they should be, right? I agree with that part. But also, I just think in general, as I've said many times before, working is good for you. You know, it's good to be a productive member of society. It'll make you live longer. You'll be healthier. And you know, you should work longer. I mean, you can. When the arbitrary 65 number was created, on average, I think they said, and Gary, you'll know this better than I will, as your next career, I'm sure you study this a lot, but you know, people lived about 4 years in retirement, right? They lived to 69. Now they live 20 years, 30 years, and that means we got to plan for that. We got to invest for that, for sure. But also, you know, I think working is good for you.
I agree completely. I think most people should, well, all of America should reevaluate what we think of as retirement. You know, I think perhaps retirement is maybe a change in lifestyle if you want to transition into, you know, a little bit more travel or, you know, I mean, to everyone, it's different. But I think, you know, this process of today, you know, baby boomers have the ability, and many of them have done this, of, you know, the first 20 years of their lives has been consumed as obviously being a child and learning, going through education. You work for 30 years, and then in your mid-50s, you have amassed enough and have the ability to retire. And if you retire after 30 years of work...
That's if you've done it right, or,
right,
you know,
right.
Done it semi-right. Hopefully you did it even sooner, but yeah.
Right. So 20 years not working, 30 years working, and the ability to do another 30 or 40 not working if, you know, the advances in healthcare continue, that's just not a survivable model for a society, you know, to contribute for 30 and not contribute for 50 or 60. Plus, it's just hard on the individual, like you said. You know, the people who live really long lives in general, I think the studies will show, are very active, right? You know, and both physically and mentally.
They're always working on a project. You know, they've always got something going on. And I think that's very, very good and very stimulating. So folks, look, if you're listening to this and you're thinking you're at retirement age and you're complaining about how bad things are because you know, you have to keep your job as a greeter at Walmart, quit complaining. No, I'm just kidding. I doubt any of our listeners are greeters at Walmart, but it's good to work. I think that is just good for you. And maybe it's part-time. Hopefully it's freelance type work where you can make your own hours and, you know, you can take a month off here and there if you want, but people should be working a good, you know, 10 years longer. And by choice, not by necessity, just by choice, because they want to be engaged and involved. So, yeah, good stuff. Good stuff. Did you want to talk about any others before we wrap it up? There are some amazing charts here.
No, I think those were the highlights. You know, those that certainly covered, you know, the major trends in I would say, personal economics and real estate and, you know, the job market. And, you know, I think there are, as we said earlier on, there are some things that can sway studies like this. You know, he cobbled together some amazing charts from many different studies and locations, and so it's a challenge for him to put them all into one article. But I think it told a great story, you know, and I think it's a eye-opening story on a lot of those charts.
It really is. It really is. Gary, give out your website.
So the best website to find me is paradigmlife.net/about. And then /Gary Pinkerton. And I just wrote an ebook that covers some of these topics, and I'd love to pass that to anyone who would find of use.
Is that ebook available there?
It is, yes, sir.
Okay, fantastic. Gary Pinkerton, client, Venture Alliance member, and former submarine captain and hack economist. How's that?
The hack. Focus on hack.
Hack economist. Yeah, absolutely. That was a very interesting discussion. Thank you for joining us today, and we appreciate your business and appreciate having you on the show.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own,
And if you require specific legal or tax advice, or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.